not.
The Beatles.
Those circuses on the air.
When the president doesn't.
Sometimes you feel like
that means that it is not illegal.
Sometimes you don't.
Tear down this wall.
Here's Johnny.
Hey, Luke. May the force be with you.
It was you, Kristen. Shot
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Oh, we're not gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
John has been waiting a long time to take the reins.
My name is Dave Letterman. Last night, I became a father. Thank you very much.
Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
For the third time in six seasons, it's one goal achieved. The Chicago Blackhawks win the Stanley Cup.
It's in time, and the Chicago Cubs win the World Series. The Cubs have done it.
And now, this is history.
You're going to need outstanding hosts.
With Dave Plyer.
It's a guy, but I love you.
And Dave Schwann on 720 WGN.
We've got a few things to talk about today. You know, it's funny. You know, year after year, I always look at what we covered last year, because history doesn't change, you know?
Well, yeah, 150 years ago,
yeah,
that's right.
Exactly. But I realized that for some reason this week, I have always been off, and we've never put together a history segment for this, what happened this week, which is kind of crazy.
For the middle of April.
For the middle of April. For some strange reason, I'm looking back and I'm like, nope, I have never been here. It was nice to do some groundwork research on some of this stuff, but I know you'll enjoy this one. 1865, also this week, Lincoln assassin John Wilkes Booth was killed when Union soldiers tracked him down to a Virginia farm 12 days after he assassinated President Lincoln.
Right. That's right. And ironically, they caught him quickly in some sort of a barn, I believe, and set fire to it. And, you know, he had to leave, and then they finally got him. But he was in the audience when Lincoln gave his incredible second inaugural speech. He had all this planned out.
He had a bigger thing planned out. I mean, he was going to try to kill Lincoln, Andrew Johnson,
and
William Seward, right?
Right,
I mean, yeah,
right.
Yeah. Seward was stabbed by Lewis Payne, but survived while the man assigned to kill Johnson did not carry out his assignment. So he just kind of scooted by on that one.
Mm-hmm.
Here's something you'll find fascinating. So in the mid-1950s, the last living eyewitness to the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln at Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C. was a gentleman named Mr. Samuel J. Seymour, and was the mystery guest on a 1956 episode of the game show I've Got a Secret. He was 96 years old at the time of his appearance, passed away just a couple months later. The host of the game show was Gary Moore, with panelists Bill Cullen, Jane Meadows, Henry Morgan, and Lucille Ball. Just amazing that someone was still alive from that time in the early days of television. Let's take a listen.
Will you tell our panel, please, what your name is and where you're from?
My name's Samuel J. Seymour. I'm from Maryland.
This is Mr. Seymour from Maryland. And we brought Mr. Seymour all the way up from Maryland, and by golly, he got in a hotel and fell down the steps and gave himself a shiner. And we urged him not to come on the show tonight, as a matter of fact, and finally got in touch with his doctor, and the doctor said it was up to Mr. Seymour. Mr. Seymour said he wouldn't miss it. So here he is, and feeling apparently pretty good. Now then, Mr. Seymour, how old are you, by the way, sir?
96.
96 years old. Now, sir, if you'll whisper your secret to me, I'm sure the folks at home would like to know what it is. Well, now, to help classify his secret, I will tell you it concerns something that he witnessed. And, Bill Cullen, we'll start with you. Something that he saw. Something he saw happen.
This thing that Mr. Seymour saw, does it have historical significance?
Does this have historical significance, Mr. Seymour? I would say yes, wouldn't you, sir?
I can't hear him very good. You have to tell me what you
have. Yeah, there's quite a distance between our desks here. Let's all speak up, huh?
Does it have political significance?
It had political significance at the time.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, if you're 96, that would make Mr. Seymour born in 1860.
Hey, Henry, you're such a mathematician.
Yeah, he's been writing over there all the time. This thing, did it have anything to do with the Civil War, Mr. Seymour?
No, it had not to do with the Civil War. Well, let's say indirectly it was concerned with the Civil War.
Did it?
All right, an answer?
Mm-hmm. Did it concern a famous person in American history? Very well-known person.
Did it concern a famous person, Mr. Seymour?
Yeah.
Yep.
Would it help me to know who this person was?
What did that?
He wants to know if it would help him to know who this person was, and he has to know who that is, yes.
Was this man, did this man hold political office?
Did this man hold political office, sir?
Yeah.
Yes. $20 down and $60 to go, and we go to Jane Meadows.
McKinley.
Mr. Seymour.
Henry is being his usual helpful self by whispering to Jane, McKinley.
And I'm not listening. Mr. Seymour, would this person have ever been president of the United States?
Was he ever president, this man?
Oh, I think he was once.
Would it have been Abraham Lincoln?
It was Abraham Lincoln, yes.
You witnessed something to do with Abraham Lincoln. Was this a pleasant thing?
Was it a pleasant thing you saw, sir?
Not very pleasant, I don't think.
No.
I was scared to death, over.
He said, no, he was scared to death.
Would it have had anything to do with the President Lincoln's death, by any chance?
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, yes.
Did Mr. Seymour witness the shooting of President Lincoln?
About Mr. Seymour through a recent article in the American Weekly, and said, I saw Lincoln shot. And this article is by Samuel J. Seymour, and it goes on to say that Mr. Seymour was 5 years old at the time. He had been taken to Ford's Theater by some good friends, and the curious thing was that when he was this youth, 5 years of age, when he saw Booth jump from the box to the stage, at which time he broke his leg, his only concern was not for the president, because he didn't realize that the president had been shot, but the poor man who fell out of the balcony. And that's all of his memory is of going to the theater and seeing a man fall out of the balcony. Sir, it's been a great joy and you might say an honor to have you. You are, by the way, the only living witness of that tragic event.
1954, the polio vaccine trials began. So few diseases frightened parents more in the early part of that 20th century than did polio. I mean, you always hear, when you hear polio, you think of FDR. You know,
right.
A lot in all this. Polio struck in the warm summer months, sweeping through towns and epidemics every few years. Though most people recovered quickly from polio, some suffered temporary or permanent paralysis and even death. Many polio survivors were disabled for life.
Was my aunt.
Is that right?
Yes. She contracted it when she was 11 and wasn't able to walk without the aid
braces.
Of braces and crutches. Yeah.
A lot of young
people. She got around amazingly well. She's a remarkable woman, ahead of her time, and we'll talk about her at some point. But yes, it directly impacted our family.
Here is a original newsreel when they broke the news that a vaccine had come about.
This is polio, the cruel centuries-old crippler of children. Enlarged 77,000 times, these are actual polio viruses. To the University of Michigan campus in 1955 came hundreds of scientists hoping to hear the words that would signal the end of polio's long and ruthless reign of terror.
Well, and as we deal with this pandemic, the polio epidemic started in Vermont in 1894, caused 27,000 cases and 6,000 deaths in the U.S. The disease occurred sporadically until the Salk vaccine was developed in 1954. And as the vaccine became widely available, the cases declined. The last polio case in the U.S. was reported in 1979. We'll be right back at 720 WGN.
Don't know much about history, don't know much biology, don't know much about a science book.
1957, Elvis had his custom-built music gates installed at Graceland. Have you been at Graceland?
No.
Oh, Dave, holy smokes.
But you know what, though? Yeah. What I've been watching, this great documentary on HBO about Elvis.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's an HBO documentary. I think it's called The Searcher or something like that.
Okay.
And it's pretty cool. They showed the gates. yeah. On there at the end.
It's amazing to walk through there, because when you walk in there, you think you're going to see more of a museum, and you're walking into his house in the shag carpeting. There's just some ropes up, but I mean, you're just, it's amazing that you just have access to walking through his house.
Mm-hmm.
And his TV room that has like six tube TVs on a wall in the basement.
Yeah.
But the gates are legendary.
Hey, Dave Schwann, is that the one where, I forget Elvis's mistress's name, but was that the one where she was saying that Elvis knew what he was doing when he overdosed? I thought I read somewhere recently that was one of the reports when she was interviewed.
I haven't seen the second part yet.
Oh,
so
okay.
That probably that most likely will be in the...
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. I do remember when I heard that Elvis had died. You know, where were you and what were you doing? You know.
I was 10, I think. And I remember seeing the headline when I went to the grocery store. And I remember buying that newspaper with the quarter or whatever I had in my hand and brought it home.
Yeah.
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 1968, the Beatles' new company, Apple Records, turned down an offer to sign new artist David Bowie. Apple later signed Mary Hopkin, James Taylor, Badfinger, Billy Preston. But that record label, I think, just finally is not functional. Like, just a few years ago, stopped recording new music. But Apple Records was around for a very long time, and it all started in 1968, right as the Beatles were ending.
The last couple albums that they came out with, Let It Be and Abbey Road, both on Apple. Yes.
That's right. 1970, the first Earth Day. So an event, of course, made to increase public awareness of the world's environmental issues. Millions of Americans, including students from thousands of colleges and universities, always participate in those rallies and marches and educational programs. It was the brainchild of Senator Gaylord Nelson of Wisconsin, who was a staunch environmentalist who hoped to provide unity to the grassroots environmental movement. Here is a little bit of a clip from the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite on the very first Earth Day.
This is a CBS News special, Earth Day, a question of survival, with CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite.
Good evening. A unique day in American history is ending, a day set aside for a nationwide outpouring of mankind seeking its own survival. Earth Day, a day dedicated to enlisting all the citizens of a bountiful country in the common cause of saving life from the deadly byproducts of that bounty, the fouled skies, the filthy waters, the littered earth. As a demonstration, its success was mixed, beyond expectations here, far below there. No one now can know exactly how many took part. We do have an idea how many planned participation, student groups in 2,000 colleges and 10,000 lower schools, citizen groups in 2,000 communities. By one measurement, Earth Day failed. It did not unite. It did attract that broad cross-section of America its sponsors wanted. Not quite. Its demonstrators were predominantly young, predominantly white, predominantly anti-Nixon. Often its protests appeared frivolous, its protesters curiously carefree. Yet the gravity of the message of Earth Day still came through. Act or die. We begin our report with Bruce Morton in Denver.
Place for Purple Mountains.
So there you have a little bit there from Walter Cronkite, which... I always trust what he has to say.
Yeah.
Even in death.
What a wonderful opening for a broadcast.
That's something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
Very cool. 1977. Studio 54 opened. Remember how big that was?
Yeah,
even it was in New York,
sure.
But you hit it here. So it was designed, the actual studio, which I didn't know the history of this until I did some research. It was designed by architect Eugene DeRosa. It opened in 1927 as the Gallo Opera House. And then the Gallo Theater, named for its owner, Fortune Gallo.
He was then the winemaker, probably.
It could be. Oh, yeah. Then the New Yorker Theater, 1939. In 1943, CBS purchased the theater, renaming it Studio 52. From the 1940s to the 70s, CBS used the location as a radio and TV stage that housed such shows as What's My Line? I didn't know this. This disco.
I didn't either.
The $64,000 Question, Video Village, Password to Tell the Truth, Beat the Clock, The Jack Benny Show, I've Got a Secret, Ted Mack and the Original Amateur Hour, and Captain Kangaroo. And even soap opera Love of Life was produced there until 1975. So for 2 years, CBS was looking for a buyer. They transformed it into the nightclub. Steve Rubel and Ian Schrager with Jack Ducey as a financial backer, and they operated the company as Broadway Catering Corp. It only took six weeks to transform the theater into a nightclub. Because what is it? Probably they just painted it black.
Yeah.
And inside.
Put in a bunch of disco lights.
Yeah.
They had the stage.
Yeah, yeah. And it cost $400,000 to do that. And
I think they made their money back.
Yeah, I think they did. Yeah. But that spawned all kinds of albums. There was a Studio 54 album, if you remember.
Yes, there was.
That's what Freak Out was from. Yeah. 78, 1 year later, the Blues Brothers made their debut, their world premiere on Saturday Night Live. Let's take a little listen. This is them first live on stage at Rockefeller Plaza in New York, long before the movie. Garrett Morris. Waiting for them to start singing a little bit here. There's a lot of dancing going on.
Yeah. And that number was in the movie, too.
It was.
Big
yep.
production number on Maxwell Street.
It was. It was. Classic, man.
I have a favorite line in that movie. Oh, here we go with Soul Man. We have to play this.
There it is. Hey, 2009, last thing, GM announced its plan to phase out Pontiac. So you remember back in, I think it was 2004, Oldsmobile went away.
Yep.
Which was a big deal.
Yep.
And then the last Pontiac badge cars were built in December of 2009 with one final vehicle in January 2010. And of course, the Firebirds were the big ones.
That's right.
In the 70s and 80s. And by the way, you can still, so there's a company called, in Tallahassee, Trans Am Worldwide has been converting fifth-generation Chevrolet Camaros, SSs, into Firebird Trans Am tributes for the past couple of years. You can actually get one. It's called Trans Am Worldwide. Here's a classic commercial.
Its family name, Firebird, an Indian temple that promises youth, beauty, and strength. And in 1977, the Pontiac Trans Am is destined to become America's number one sports car.
Have a great weekend, Dave.
You too, Dave.